I think so. Does that look right? Good morning to everyone. I see that there are a few brave souls to come sit in a history class. History is not usually the most, the subject that most people like the most, that many like the most. But I trust that that we'll be able to get a little bit out of this here this morning. So, just for a little bit of an overview of what my understanding is, what my assignment is to give a history lesson this morning on the Pacific Northwest, and then take a little bit of time and try to share with you some pointers in teaching history, and then some interaction. So, and there'll probably be a little bit of interaction as we go along. So, to start here, I have chosen a segment of the Pacific Northwest history, obviously, because we cannot cover everything. And I've entitled the lesson this morning, "Who Will Rule the Pacific Northwest?" Now, jumping maybe ahead in history from who will rule, I remember as a student in the grade school right in Tangent, north of here, I went to the public grade school. We had a music teacher, and she taught us a lot of different songs, and this would be a little different than what we're used to in our Christian day schools. But one of my favorite songs was a song of the pioneers that used to come across, that came across the prairies to Oregon country. And here's the way the song went. "Hurry up, old pioneers, keep moving. Your faithful little band must never fail. Cross the great divide, side by side we'll ride down the Oregon Trail. There'll be cattle on each ranch in Oregon. There'll be valleys filled with golden grain. There'll be apples on each branch in Oregon, for there will be plenty of sun and rain." Have you ever heard that song? Huh? Oh my, you're missing something. That's a great song. And I think about that almost every time I pick apples. You know, I think about that song. Okay, so this is a little bit more the view, maybe, of what we have of the Pacific Northwest. It is known as a land of very valuable production, many agricultural crops, timber, mining, fishing. But when the Pacific Northwest was being explored by early explorers, they weren't interested in wheat or fir trees or cattle. What were they interested in? Does anyone know what the early explorers were interested in when they started exploring the coast along the Pacific Northwest?
Silver.
Part of silver? And what was the others? Yes, although that came a little bit later. The first thing they were actually searching for was
Northwest Passage.
There you got it. The Northwest Passage. To find a water route that would go through the continent to the Atlantic. Okay, you really should have studied your lesson, and you should have this all filled out, but I'm going to not grade you too hard. If you want to pass these on or back. Oh, I better keep one of those. Now, since you didn't have time to study your lesson or to fill out your study sheet, you may do so as we go, or you may, as the Brother Martin was saying today, maybe you're not even going to communicate by even listening. You'll just have your mind somewhere else. All right. So as we go along here, now I'm going to, just a minute. I'm going to pass out another sheet before we go any further. And what this is a timeline. It's just kind of, it's a homemade timeline, just to give a little bit of an idea, I'm going to pass one on back, of what some of the dates that we will be talking about here. Okay, the first date on that timeline is 1513, and there was a man by the name of Balboa. He was from Spain, and he sailed from Spain to South America, crossed the Isthmus of Panama, and saw the Pacific Ocean. And he declared the whole Pacific shore, from one end to the other, a possession of Spain. Now, can someone tell me, just before this timeline begins, there's a very important event in world history. What that was? Had to do with sailing. Columbus discovered America. How many years before Balboa found the Pacific?
58.
Pardon?
58.
Don't think so. 21, because it was 1492. That's 8 years to 1500. This is 1513. You were probably looking at 1550. Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay, so only 25 years after Columbus discovered America, Balboa, he went clear across to South America and crossed the land to find the Pacific. All right, in 1578, you've probably heard of Sir Francis Drake, and he was exploring for England, and he claimed the California coast for England. And in his shipping career, he had a lot of skirmishes with the Spanish, because the Spanish had found gold, and he wanted the gold, and so on. In the early 1700s, as near as I could find, 1728, we go down quite a ways, there was a sailor by the name of Bering, and you will find his name in a lot of the Alaska today. But he, Vitus Bering, and he reached Alaska from Siberia. Two centuries after Drake, we have another English explorer by the name of James Cook, and he explored the Pacific Northwest waters. His crew discovered something that was quite a catalyst for the history of the Pacific Northwest, and that was the sea otter. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever seen a sea otter. Quite a few of you. How many of you ever seen one in the wild? Good. Where'd you see it? But at what location?
California.
In California. Okay. I don't think I've ever seen it in the... You know, my first exposure to the sea otter was at the aquarium at Newport, the Oregon Aquarium. And there's these furry animals. You know, they're playful, and they get on their back, and they float, and cute little things. Well, that... When the sea otter was discovered all along the Pacific Northwest coast, and they began to be hunted, and the pelts were taken to China and sold to the rich in China, then everybody wanted to get in on the game, and so they started coming and hunting the sea otter. What's interesting is that the Russians knew all about this before James Cook's crew discovered this. And they were already doing this years before. Okay, then we go on down a little bit later to 1792. There was a sailor by the name of George Vancouver. He also was of England, and he explored the coast of Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. And he was the first white man to explore the Puget Sound area around Seattle. At the same time, there was a captain from the U.S. by the name of Robert Gray. And he was the first to sail into the mouth of the Columbia River. And I don't know why, but he did not formally claim that for the U.S. And what's interesting is there was a tradition among the explorers that whoever discovered and claimed the mouth of a river claimed all the land that river drains. Well, can you imagine with me all the land that the Columbia drains? It starts clear up in B.C. And about all of Washington, Idaho, through the Snake River system, Oregon, you know, and the Willamette River to the south and so on. And so He could have, but it probably wouldn't have necessarily held. But he did not claim it for the U.S. But he got to talking to Captain Vancouver and told him what he had found. So Captain Vancouver sent a contingent of sailors up to Columbia about as far as Corbett. Those of you who know the Columbia River, they're just a little bit of east of Portland. And there they claimed the land for Britain. All right, and so what we find, and I didn't mention too much about the French, we'll get into that just a little bit more later, but we have explorers that came from France, Spain, Russia, England, and the United States, and they all tried to get a piece of the wealth that was to be had in the Pacific Northwest. And as somebody mentioned, the main basis for the fur trade in those early years. So in your little questionnaire here, those are the five countries. France, Spain, Russia, England, and the U.S. Now, France never had a really strong hold in the Northwest, although they had sent some expeditions there. But they lost a lot of presence in America during the French and Indian War, which of course took place in the eastern part of the continent. And then later, they had some holdings, particularly in the southeast, and they sold their property to the United States, and that was called what? The Louisiana Purchase. And that was in 1803, and you'll see that on the chart there in 1803, the Louisiana Purchase. And so after the United States purchased that, President Polk decided that he should find out what they bought, and sent a expedition to the Northwest, and that expedition was called Lewis and Clark. And we could have just spent our whole time on that. And I'm just basically mentioning that, but our focus this morning is going to be who wins out of these five nations that were trying to control the Pacific Northwest. So in the Louisiana Purchase, there was no question that the western boundary of that was the Mississippi River. But how far north did it go? How far south did it go? How far west did it go? Nobody knew. And so that was part of the reason for some of these explorations. Speaking of France, there were many Frenchmen then that were in America that stayed and became trappers. And if you read about the mountain trappers, some of those things, a lot of them were French. Okay, now I'm going to pass out a little map, yes? Okay, on this map, you will see that this is... I'm sorry. That kind of got cut off on the left side. It should say Oregon Territory, 1846. This is what was known as the Oregon Territory, known as that by the United States. Britain called it the Columbia District. The reason I'm showing you this at this point, in 1819, that would have been right, well, let me back up a little bit here. In 1818, England and the U.S. agreed that the 49th parallel would be the border between the United States and the British holdings, which became Canada, and that was from Minnesota to the Stony Mountains at that time. That's how it was described, to the Stony Mountains. And so if you'll see on the map, it doesn't really show it real clear here, but the 49th parallel, that became the boundary. All right. But Oregon Country was wide open for both countries. and it was not in either camp. But there were still those who were trying to gain their foothold here. And if you see the Mexican territory at the bottom, that is parallel 42. Finally, there was a treaty where Spain gave up their rights to anything north of that 42nd parallel. And that parallel today is the southern border of Oregon and Idaho. South of that is California and Nevada and Utah. And so that was in Spain's territory at that time. And that was in 1819. Shortly after that, in 1824, Russia gave up their rights up to, and I don't know how to say this, maybe somebody can help me, but it's the 54-40. You'll see that up there at the top, and that was right at the bottom of Alaska, at 54-40. Russia gave up their rights south of that. And of course, France was not trying to, at this point anymore, trying to have any possession here. And so that left England and the U.S., and I'm saying England and Britain as interchangeable. They were the only contenders now for the Pacific Northwest, and they agreed, they were nice and agreed to occupy this jointly. Okay, and so, as I said, west of the Stony Mountains, or west of the Rocky Mountains, was the Oregon Country, or as the British called it, the Columbia District. And the Oregon Country had joint occupation. Both peoples were free to develop it. The resources of this vast region were free and open to the citizens from either nation. All right, now let's go just a little bit further and look at a little bit of the American and the British involvements here. On the chart here, you will see that the first establishment of a fort by the Americans on the West Coast was Fort Astoria in 1811, and that was actually before the 49th parallel was set further east. And then we have this 1811, then we have the treaty with Spain, the treaty with Russia. And then the next thing I'd like to look at is the Hudson Bay Company. You've probably all heard of the Hudson Bay Company. By 1821, almost the entire Pacific Northwest was controlled by this British monopoly called the Hudson Bay Company. And their interest was fur trading. And so they had outposts, they had stores, they had places where the Indians, the trappers, the mountain men, they could come and they could exchange their furs, their pelts, mainly beaver pelts at that time. Or there would have been others like fox and that sort of thing, but mainly beaver. And they traded that for goods, you know, whether it be coffee or sugar or knives or whatever. And so these stores would have all these goods that they could trade. And of course, it was quite a lucrative business. Does anyone know what the main use was for the beaver pelts?
Felt hats.
Felt hats. In where?
Europe.
That's right. So these beaver pelts would go to Europe and these fellows would walk around with these felt hats. Okay. Very good. And so, economically, the Oregon Territory was pretty well controlled by the British, the Hudson Bay Company. They had their main operation was at Fort Vancouver. Fort Vancouver is just across the line from Portland in the state of Washington. How many of you ever visited Fort Vancouver? Two. And I think you're both from the same family. All right. Okay, it's an interesting place to visit. And so there was a man there by the name of John McLaughlin. And if I was going to give a test on this today, that is one name I would want you to remember, is John McLaughlin. He was a very important figure in the history of the Pacific Northwest. He was an imposing man. He stood at 6'4", had snow-white hair, and had piercing eyes, and he had a temper. But he was also very kind. Now, I don't know how that goes together, but he helped a lot of people, especially those who came across the prairies. They would come, and he would try to help them get established. The Indians referred to him as the Great White Father. And so he managed Fort Vancouver for 22 years from 1824 to 1845. And later, he became known as the Father of Oregon. Okay, so he was told by the Hudson Bay Company, here are your responsibilities. You are to monopolize the fur trade. You're to keep peace with the Indians. And you are to discourage any agriculture in your region. And, of course, this had to do with money, making money. So Fort Vancouver became the center of activity in the Pacific Northwest. And so every year there were ships that would come from London, would come from England. They would drop off supplies and the trade goods, and they would take the furs back. And so it was the center of the fur trade of the Pacific Northwest. The influence from Fort Vancouver went all the way to the Rockies to the east, actually to the Hawaiian Islands to the west, and to the Russian Alaska to the north, and into Mexican-controlled California. It had a huge influence. And so Dr. McLaughlin, as he was known, and by the way, that doctor, he was somewhat of a medical doctor, he watched out over 34 outposts, 24 ports, six ships, and 600 employees. And so under his management, the Columbia Department for the British remained very profitable. And it had a lot to do with the demand for the beaver hats. McLaughlin was a good administrator. He was fair. He was generous. And it was a policy of the Hudson Bay Company not to help settlers in agriculture because it would infringe on the fur trade. But you know, McLaughlin saw these settlers coming. They were struggling and almost starving, had nothing to eat, and he couldn't just let them go. He lent them aid, even though that was against company policy. Well, the fur trade then declined. I think I have that here, 1840. That declined for two reasons. One, they had pretty well just trapped out the beaver. Weren't as many as around anymore. By the way, Oregon is known as the beaver state. You don't see them very often anymore, once in a while. But also the styles had changed in Europe. And so there was not as much demand for the beaver hat. And so that declined, but also something else happened. There were missionaries that were sent to the Oregon country from the U.S. And the one missionary that's rather interesting is Jason Lee. He came to Oregon as a Methodist missionary in 1834. He started a mission on the banks of the Willamette River west of Brooks. There's a sign there that says Willamette Mission State Park. And it's west of Brooks. And if you go out there, you'll find a place where he had started his mission, but it wasn't a good place. After several years, he abandoned that and rebuilt at a place called Chemeketa. Anyone know where Chemeketa is? What it is today? Chemeketa is actually the state capital of Oregon, which is Salem. And so that's where he built rebuilt his mission. So as time went on, the fur trade almost came to nothing, and here you have these trappers that What are they going to do now? Well, they got to looking. There was an area just as we would know it today, south and west of Portland, a large prairie that was called the French Prairie. And they got to looking at that land. And you see, this is something that the Kalapuya Indians had cleared, and they kept it open for, I think, even for deer and that sort of thing. But that's where they had their camas. They raised their camas, and they would harvest that every year. That was one of their main food staples. Well, these former trappers, they got to looking at this, and you know, this is a wide open area, and it would grow good crops. And they went in there and started plowing, and raising wheat and building fences so they had place for their cattle. And of course, there got to be skirmishes with some of the Indians over that. And more and more people came from the United States to settle there. In 1841, there was a meeting at a place called Champouy. And this was right at the northern edge of the French Prairie. And they gathered supposedly to discuss how to deal with the predators, the wolves, the grizzlies, the cougars. But behind it, this whole thing was they wanted to discuss what to do about the government of this Oregon Territory. I forgot to say that John McLaughlin, desire for the Oregon country was that it would be a separate nation. That this whole thing would be a separate nation and that British and U.S. interests would not prevail. But there was still this feeling, you know, between the British and the U.S. Who's going to be come out on top on this? And so they gathered there at Champouy and they appointed this Methodist missionary Jason Lee as the chairman of their meeting. And on May 2nd of 1843, there were about half of the men that had settled the area that came to this meeting. And that being a little over 100 men, there was about probably 200 white men living there at that time. So there was a crowd of about 100 men that lived in the valley. And they actually gathered at the Hudson Bay store, which was British. The Hudson Bay had just built a new store there at Champouy because they wanted now, since they weren't making profits on the beaver, maybe they could make profits now on the wheat. So they put in a grist mill and all that. So there was a vote taken there in 1843, are we going to set up a provisional government? And those who came, there were some that were in the blue and gray colored dress. They would have been the Americans. Those that were red, they would be British. And so who was going to win out? And so they took a vote there that day. And the vote was 52-50 to set up a provisional government and to appeal to Washington, D.C. to become a government of underneath the U.S. All right. That same year, if I understand right, in 1843 would have been the arrival of the first wagon train. And so more and more Americans were coming into this area, and percentage-wise, there were less and less British. And so there got to be a number of the American settlers that resented the British presence. And so, 2 years later, President Polk, he ordered all the British in Oregon country to move out within a year. Get out of here. Did he have a right to do that? Probably not. And so, it was very close that there was going to be a war between Britain and the U.S. Come very close to coming to that. But both countries had other issues going on. The U.S. had their battlefronts going on in the south there in Texas. They hardly wanted to have another battle going on in, with the British in the northwest. And so they finally compromised and they settled the dispute and they decided to extend the 49th parallel. If you see here, the yellow is at the 49th parallel. There was a treaty then. In 1846, everything south of that was U.S. and north of that was Britain, except for Vancouver Island. A little bit of that is south of the 49th parallel, and it became part of Britain. And so to sum this lesson up here this morning, we see that the Pacific Northwest has a rich history of explorers, fur traders, and settlers. And actually, I don't know of any major war over the to have supremacy over the Pacific Northwest. And it was finally peacefully divided between Britain and the United States. And the United States and Canada have remained peaceful neighbors for about 1 3/4 centuries. I think that is commendable. That's noteworthy. And so I hope that this has stirred your interest just a little bit in the in what took place in the early days before we knew of apples on each branch in Oregon and cattle on each ranch. That was down the road quite a ways. So that is the lesson for this morning now. I don't know if you got all these things filled out. Any questions here on the pardon? Okay, how do you spell McLaughlin? Let me look at my notes. It's MC capital LOUGHLIN. Got that? MC capital LOUGHLIN. Any other questions? Okay, any questions on the just the lesson in general? Now, this is where it gets really tricky for a teacher. You can ask me a question. I'll say, I have no idea. But any questions? Yes?
When did they use the slogan, 5440 or 5?
Okay, that, and I thought of bringing that up. That was right before President Polk was it, or was it Tyler? I think it was Polk. Was elected president. The Democrats and the Republicans both had their candidates, and both of them were opposed to annexing Texas as part of the U.S. And so I think it was the Democrats. They decided they're going to put in a black horse, dark horse candidate, and that was the slogan that he used. And I think it was supposed to be that 5440 or fight. And there were a lot of the radical people that, I mean, they wanted to hold him to that, but he really didn't want to go to war. Does that answer that, Kevin?
Yeah, I just remember that.
Yeah, that's good.
Figure out where that fit in.
Yeah. And that 5440, that's the bottom of Alaska. And then, can someone tell me how the U.S. actually finally got the Russian holdings in North America?
Seward's Folly,
yes. Seward bought Alaska from Russia, and that became U.S. territory then, later a state. Any other questions?
About when did the first Mennonite come to?
1876, to Oregon here.
Mm-hmm. That was not part of the Oregon Trail.
No, that was, I think they would have came by train.
What was that church?
Probably in the Hubbard area, Woodburn, Hubbard area, I think would have been the first settlers, Mennonite settlers. Mm-hmm. So,
Do you have any, anything to tell us about pig wars? I understood there was an incident or a series of incidents. between the British and the American
stuff? You know, in my reading, I read about the pig wars, and I didn't take the time to research that. So no, the answer is this teacher does not know. Sorry.
This has something to do with a pig rooted in somebody's garden shelf before they're on the parallel.
Well, that'd be worthwhile having a war over with it. No, I know there was. I run onto that, the pig war, but I'm not sure. And so maybe my statement of not having wars is not quite correct either. Yeah. Yeah.
What happened to the Indians?
What happened to the Indians? There were so many of them that died by disease. The white men brought diseases like measles and maybe smallpox and some of those things, and their bodies were not used to their immunity did not throw it off. And so many of the Indians died, and then as the white men took over more and more land, they were put onto reservations, and eventually, yeah, just a number of reservations where the Indians were put. And but it was a small percentage of the initial population.
What was the name of that main crop that he grew in French
Prairie?
Camas.
Okay, have you ever seen around here in these low areas in the spring? You'll see a. Something about this high, a dark purple bloom. You know what I'm talking about? If right there across from our place in the woods, right across, there's this camas growing there. And what it is, it's a root. It'd be a little bit like, you know, use like we'd maybe use a potato. They would pound it and make their food out of that. A very important food item for the Indians.
Is that something that the white settlers continued to grow?
I don't think so. I think they just took over and grew wheat. Yeah, I don't think they cared about the camas. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Were there any significant gold discoveries?
Not until like the gold rush of in San Francisco of 1849, that sort of thing. But no, there was in South America. Like the Spanish, you know, they found gold among the Maya Indians. And that's where there got to be skirmishes between Spain and England trying to control that gold. But up here, no, they didn't find gold. Yeah.
So how long did the Oregon Trail last and how many settlers came across
it? I think it lasted about 15 years. And as far as the number of settlers, I'm thinking somewhere between 50 and 100,000. I know that's a big gap. I'm not quite sure on that. I mean, a lot of them died on the way, too. So.
I was thinking I had read a number like 40,000 or something.
That could be. So.
Another interesting thing I'd like to add to what you said, but one thing that caused a collapse of the beaver trade is the reason they use beaver for their skull hats is because beaver fur will press. And make felt. So they shear the beaver, get the fur, and press it, and make felt. Well, in Spain, they discovered a kind of sheep, the merino wool, merino sheep, that didn't used to be available. It bred as a special sheep. That wool will press, like felt, and you can make a felt hat from that wool. And they guarded those sheep tremendously. I mean, it was some of the most valuable things in the world. And but those sheep, somebody smuggled some sheep out of the area, and then there was merino sheep everywhere, and you could press a hat that was almost beaver felt quality for a fraction of the beaver felt price, and that contributed as a style change. Everything it contributed to the collapse of the huge French and British.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, I wasn't aware of that.
But it was a contributor. It wasn't
Okay, maybe we'll have some more questions. I'm going to take just a little bit of time now, since you are teachers. Let me give a disclaimer here. I have never taught school. So I have never talked Pacific Northwest history. I've never taught U.S. history, but I have taught a lot of Mennonite history at Bible school and different churches. So I'm supposed to give you a little bit of an idea of how to teach history. So I'm going to just say a few things here, and then if we have time, well, maybe we have some more questions on the subject here. But history, I looked at my dictionary at home, and the first definition of history is a tale or a story. And so somehow, and I don't know that I did a very good job of that this morning, but you need to make a story out of history. The second definition is a chronological record of significant events, often including an explanation of their causes. Let me say that again. It's a chronological, record of significant events, often including an explanation of their causes. Now, it's pretty hard to teach history without interpreting history. And my interpretation of history may not be correct. And I think we need to keep that in mind, need to be open to. If somebody says, hey, that's really not the way it was, well, let's dig in and let's find out. The teacher's interests and biases will become evident. And what you probably found this morning, and I'll go into that just a little bit more a little bit later, what you probably found is I have, in my growing up years, I was fascinated with Dr. John McLaughlin and what went on at Fort Vancouver. I was also fascinated with the story of what took place at Chamfouille. Okay. And so the teacher's interests and biases become evident. So as you choose your main subject, and maybe you won't choose, you'll just be handed a textbook and say, here, this is what to teach, but you still have to do some choosing. I think it is important to have some human interest, because history can be boring, let's just face it. But there needs to be a little bit of human interest, and a little bit of personal experience that can tie into the lesson. That's one reason I told you about that song that we sung in grade school, was so that there's a connection with my past in this history. There should be a story that could be told, and I realize that a four-century story, a story that spans three or four centuries, is pretty hard to condense and tell an interesting story. Try to build on previous knowledge that your students have. In other words, if everything I would have said this morning was totally new to you, you'd have blipped out before we got very far. I mean, just, it would not have any interest at all. It's a little bit like a singing, where you just sing all new songs. Yeah. It's great for the musician, but for the person that likes some of these old songs, you know, you need to insert some songs that they know. Okay. I think the same thing is true in history. And so most of you know enough history to know a little bit about the Louisiana Purchase, a little bit to know that Russia owned Alaska, that Lewis and Clark made a trek out here, a lot of those things that you would know. And so you kind of tie those things together. But then you need to be selective. Now, I could have chosen all kinds of material, and I probably should have for this lesson. But I only had about a half hour time. So what are you going to select that's going to give the lesson you want to? Now, as you prepare for that, I'd like to give probably the greatest preparation that you can make to teach history is read, 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 read. Now, when I teach Mennonite history in Bible school, I've taught it for many years, and you'd think that I could just get up and just go. And I probably could, but it wouldn't be very meaningful. But I find in my preparation, I take my Mennonite history books and I read. And I read, and I read. And I don't near share all that. But you see, somebody's going to ask me about a pig war. And you need to have a little idea of what your background material is. And so you need to read. And you will benefit from background information even though you don't use it in class time. I know I've found this true. I've been giving a lecture on something and all of a sudden, oh yeah, I read that, no, I'll insert that, so on. Familiarize yourself with the surrounding facts. Now this is not possible for nearly all history lessons, but if at all possible, visit the site. You'd be amazed what that does for you. I taught church history for a number of years, but after we were in Switzerland, and I actually saw the Lamotte River where Felix Mons was drowned, and I saw the Grossmünster Church where there was the where Zwingli and Greville and Mons had their discussions. When I saw the Anabaptist cave where they worshiped for about 100 years, when I saw that barn where people went running in and hid from the hunters, this all began to make a lot more sense. And so I thought, for this class, I need to do a little visiting. So one afternoon, I had a free afternoon, so I decided to go visit Shampooey. Well, in those days, there was not an I-5. And I-5 was clogged. So I finally got off on all this. I'm fooling on this, and I went up some back roads, and I got to Shampooey at 5 o'clock, and their visitor center closes at 5. So I'm sorry. I didn't have what I had hoped to have, but even so, it helped me. And then I did go to the Willamette Mission State Park and saw that where Jason Lee had built his first mission, so on. So I got a lot more of an idea, and it just helps. Now you can't do that with every history lesson, but if at all possible, it just adds at least to the teacher's knowledge. As far as the content, as I said, lots of people consider history to be boring, and I think it depends a lot on the teacher. Are you engaged in it? Is it interesting to you? Can you convey that these people were real? That the events actually happened? That it's not just some thing of the past? I have felt, and I don't know how you feel about this, but I have felt as teachers, don't get the students bogged down with a lot of dates and names of people. Some dates are fine. And if I was actually teaching this in class, I would probably pick out 3 or 4 of these dates and develop them a little bit more. But I would not focus on a lot of individuals. Just mention them. Just some key ones that you want them to remember. Now, some dates are important, and I'm going to go back to church history. To me, it just makes a lot more sense if there are certain dates that I have in my mind. Can someone tell me what happened in 1525 in Mennonite history?
Baptism
in what country? Switzerland. Exactly. Yeah. So to me, that is a date I need to know. And because you just tie a lot of other things together with that. And there's other dates that are important. And, you know, in U.S. history, I mean, 1776 is an important date and some of those things. I have found in more recent years that a timeline for me teaching is such a good tool. And if you spend a little bit of time like I did and put a timeline together, it may not mean much to the student, but it sure helps you to keep things straight in your own mind. And I found that so true in Mennonite history. I mean, some things that took place about the same time that, you know, here's one that I did not really think about until, oh, just maybe 3 years ago. Columbus discovered America in 1492, and so awesome, 1492 and 1525, I think we've got about 33 years. 33 years after Columbus discovered America, the Anabaptist movement started. And God was already preparing a haven for his persecuted people before that movement ever started. It's an interesting connection if you start getting timelines. Okay. So I've found that in teaching, I like to have a big timeline just to go by. Now, one thing, I think it's all right, and I think it's probably a good thing, is to bring in some obscure fact, event, something that, oh, I never knew that before. And I've had in teaching American Mennonite history, talking that number of different churches, I have had different people say, you know, I knew about this and this and this, but I never knew that. There should be, in your lesson, there should be some things that were never known. Now, what would have been something that I would have shared this morning that you would have never known? Maybe nothing. How many of you have ever heard of shampooing? Not very many, a few of you.
But I did hear about 50-50 teeth, and that's really close for a pretty important
decision. Yeah, it is. So I kind of want to bring in something that interests me, something that I thought probably not too many of you would know, and something that's important to get the picture. Okay. I think that's about all I have. Any other questions or comments or something that we missed? Yes. Okay, go ahead, Dad. You probably have a better answer than I do. No, this is a discussion. Go ahead.
No, I have to ask you, I'm sorry. I teach Latin American history, and we cover some of the things there.
Okay, so what do you find out? What do you find out?
Well, go back a little bit farther. Smallpox came from Asia. The Mongols brought it from Asia, and the Europeans were absolutely decimated by it. Lots of areas of Europe, half the entire population died, and they would actually, in attacking some of the cities, like in Austria and Hungary, they would take the Mongols would take their decomposing bodies of their soldiers, who died from smallpox, and catapult them over the wall into the city, because they knew in a matter of weeks the city would be decimated and they could conquer it. And so Europe went through that. And half of Europe died. And what was left was stronger, at least in dealing with that disease. So that happened all prior to Columbus.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I had not heard some of that there.
So you're saying that only the strong white men survived, and that's why the Indians.
Right, and that Europe had to go through that process of building up some endemic resistance to smallpox, although it was still a huge killer for it.
And if you would have been a lady, you could have gone and gotten in on Ruby's talk about the Whitman mission this morning. But you see, that it very much ties into this this disease thing, because
the curious, what do we attribute that to? Because to me, look, the white men should have been, they weren't natives here. They should have been the ones at risk.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying. But yeah, that go ahead.
May I just have a little bit on that too? So measles is a tremendous killer.
Mm-hmm.
If your body has proper nutrition and you have a very healthy immune system, measles is a pretty easy disease to get and survive. So measles killed Indians by the thousands, because it was a combination of, okay, so they're maybe forced off their land, and or the buffalo are killed, or, you know, if it's in the east and they're made to walk to the west in the middle of the winter, and then their immune systems are compromised, and they didn't have nutrition, they didn't have health, and then just the common cold, you know, measles, just, you know, if you don't have vitamin D in your system, measles will make you blind. And it just, combination. And the Europeans, when they're living on their little farms, and they had their meat and their potatoes in there.
And they had their nutrition.
They could get measles, and it was no big deal.
But it sure was to the Indians. Especially there in Walla Walla there. And then they thought that Dr. Whitman had poisoned them, and so they massacred him. So, all right, anything else yet before this good class dismisses? I've enjoyed interacting with you here a little bit.
One thing, there was quite a few conflicts with the whites and Indians here in this valley, I guess.
Yes.
One incident that I remember reading about that horrified me a little bit was a white family that adopted a 9-year-old Indian boy as they were traveling over. He had been, I think his family had died. And so they adopted him and brought him here to this wonderful Willamette Valley. And when they got here, this would have been a later wagon train too. When we got to one of these towns right here, and I forget which name it is, but it's named in the story, the citizens of the town said, "That's an Indian boy." And they grabbed him and hanged him.
Is that right? Yeah, I never heard that one.
Yeah, right.
Hmm. All right. Well, thank you for your participation here.
Yeah.
That's good.
This is awesome. Come on,